Thank you, Your Honor. Peter Forbes, 14081, on behalf of the appellant, Todd Creek Village Metropolitan District. Your Honor, as an experienced counsel, I guess that means we're older. That means we have children that are somewhat older. I have, my youngest is 10, and he said, well, you're going to the Court of Appeals. What's the difference between that and a trial court? And so I said, well, the difference is a trial court, they're in charge of finding what the facts are, and a Court of Appeals is in charge of making sure the trial court followed the rules. In this case, there is a fundamental rule that the trial court broke or violated. And that rule is summarized in the Dinosaur Park Investments case by another division of this court as follows. Where defense is not pleaded or intentionally and actually tried, a court cannot render judgment thereon. And that is the problem here.
Counsel, can I interrupt you quickly? I'm sorry to start so soon. But on that Dinosaur Park case, it's my reading of that case that it's discussing an affirmative defense. Do you agree that that holding is limited to an affirmative defense?
Well, I don't think it is, but even if it was, all of the matters that, most of the matters here are matters of affirmative defenses. For example, there's a question about who had to prove who caused the seepage level of the reservoirs to exceed the contractual standard. Our view is that that is equivalent to an intervening cause defense or a material breach defense, basically claiming that we made it more difficult for them to perform or made it impossible for them to perform, or our breach was the reason that they had to perform and therefore they're excused. So those are all affirmative defenses. One of the issues with respect to the damage issue is not necessarily an affirmative defense. I think it's just a legal error by the court in applying the wrong standard. Nonetheless, it was an argument that they did not raise, specifically the question of the repair cost damages and whether it's in the reasonable expectation of the parties. The question was never raised and it was never challenged. There was never any contention made that that was outside the reasonable expectation. Now, I think even if it had been, it would have been error and was error for the court to use that standard, because reasonable expectation goes to consequential damages, not benefit of the bargain damages, is what we're talking about here. But so I don't think Dinosaur Park is limited to affirmative defenses, but if it is, each of the bases for finding no breach of contract or no liability here was an affirmative defense.
Thank you.
So this raises the question, which was briefed extensively, obviously, is did they, in fact, raise any of these defenses in their pleadings, in the trial management order, or even raise them expressly at trial? And the answer to that is no. And I think not only did we make that showing, but when you step back and say, well, if I'm a litigant and I'm raising a defense, it's pretty easy for me to show in the record where I raised it. Here's my complaint. Here's my answer to your counterclaim. Here's where I raised it. Here's the trial management order. Here's where I raised it. The fact that they're unable to do that and they go through all these gyrations, I think confirms what we've said, is none of these specific issues were raised by them as affirmative defenses. Then there's the question of whether the new defenses were intentionally and actually tried. And there's a slightly different approach that they use here. They cite the Guman case, the Padilla versus Guman, and the Edabyte case as saying, well, all you have to do is have a few questions off point that aren't objected to, and that's enough. That puts the matter at issue. I submit that that argument or that legal standard is not what's controlling in Colorado. We cited the Bill Dryland case where the Colorado Supreme Court specifically said counsel is not required to be on alert to challenge every objectionable question or answer, lest it later be made the basis of another claim than that intentionally and fairly tendered. And the Cady versus Frazier case where the court says an issue is not tried by consent just because a few questions are asked, but you've got to have no reasonable doubt that the issue was intentionally and actually tried. The Biddle case we also cited, which for some reason is still not a final decision of another panel of this court, but it, what it does is says, yes, Padilla says it's enough to ask a few questions, but then it says, nevertheless, you can't find a defense was intentionally and knowingly tried unless there's no reasonable doubt, and to do that, you've got to go through the record. And here, we did that. We showed you that, for example, let's go, could go to the four defenses at issue. The first thing the court said is, well, this repair obligation only had a two-month duration, a three-month duration, or stated differently, it only lasted until my client began to do some repair work on the reservoir.
Wasn't that just the trial court's ruling on the intervening cause defense that was raised?
It was not stated as such. But
isn't that a reasonable interpretation of what the trial court's order says?
Even if you were going to interpret it that way, what the trial court said is without us proving the pre-construction level, without us proving the level, in other words, that the pre-construction level was less than 5 gallons per minute, then we haven't established a breach. It's their burden if they're making an intervening cause, i.e. they're saying, because remember, nobody knew what the level of seepage was beforehand. And in fact, that's why this clause was put in the contract, because they wanted to close on the transaction so they could move ahead with their subdivision. Everybody knew it would take, you'd have to fill the reservoirs and then watch them. So they would be delayed in their process. So the risk that was agreed to was that, okay, if you, we'll give you a maintenance easement, we baseline, you, we'll give you the reservoirs, we'll give you the right to maintain them. And if they leak more than 5 gallons per minute, then we'll fix them. That was the basic bargain that was struck. So we had the right to do some maintenance work. You've got to take those documents together as though they're one contract. That's what the law says.
Right, but the trial court wasn't looking at whether you were doing maintenance work. It was looking at whether this was a completely intervening cause and whether you proved up your case.
Well,
we don't disprove that defense.
We don't have to prove a negative. In other words, we don't have to prove that we caused it, that we didn't cause it to seep. That's their burden of proof. The contract is very straightforward. It just says, if A, then you'll do B. If you do A, then you'll do B. What they're saying is, well, you did C, and that was an intervening cause. That excused our performance. And the trial court didn't say, what the trial court has said, no. In other words, the trial court didn't make a finding that we caused it to seep more than 5 gallons per minute. The trial court didn't make a factual finding that they'd proven their affirmative defense. What it said is without us being able to establish what it was before we did the work, then we can't even establish a breach of contract. So in other words, the trial court said to us, you have to prove that you didn't cause it to seep more than 5 gallons per minute.
Well, I guess my point is, counsel, regardless of how you view it, isn't it reasonable to view what the trial court did rule as basically a ruling on that affirmative defense, not as a, quote, reasonable duration defense, which is what you're calling it?
I don't see how it's possible to interpret it that way, because what the court actually said was, the first it said the obligation expired when we began work. That's what it said. So I don't know how we can say that that's saying, well, we had an intervening cause, and that's what caused it to expire. It just said the obligation terminated when you began work. The next thing it said was, well, you also can't prove a breach unless you can prove the pre-work seepage level. That is not a finding that that is not a finding relating to intervening cause. That's saying that, in other words, that's not a finding that they have proven that we caused it to breach the contract level. That's saying we have to prove that we didn't cause it to do that. In other words, we have to prove that we're the reason that they have to perform. That is not a finding in favor of an intervening cause defense. That's imposing a burden on us to prove it as part of our prima facie case. And that's the fundamental reason why the decision cannot fairly be read that way.
You may proceed, counsel.
Okay, thank you. I think I've addressed that issue on the reasonable duration defense. I think the only way the questions are interesting, Judge Terry, because in effect, the only way that one can reconcile the trial court's findings are to say that the trial court was doing something other than what it was doing and was ruling on issues other than the issues presented to it. I think so I've addressed, I think those are the first two. The third issue is the breach of good faith and fair dealing claim. The only comment I'd make on that is that there's an interesting case that I think shows why, in this case, it was error to rule on that basis. And that case was not cited by any of the parties in their briefs. It's the appellate case in Denny Construction Company versus City and County of Denver, 170 P. 2nd, excuse me, P. 3rd, 733.
And did you say nobody cited that case in the briefs?
I didn't think we had. Maybe we had.
No, I'm not sure.
I didn't think anybody had cited it, Your Honor. The reason I'm citing it is this case. In this case, the court held that, well, pleading a breach of contract and a cross claim with everything else that happened before trial was sufficient to put a breach of covenant of good faith and fair dealing claim fairly at issue. But what happened in the Denny case, and that didn't happen here, is, first of all, here we didn't even have a counterclaim or affirmative defense of prior breach until the trial management order. And it didn't reference a breach of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing. In Denny case, by contrast, what happened is there was an allegation of breach in the cross-claim, here by analogy, in the answer and affirmative defenses. So that's distinguishable. So that was upfront in Denny. It wasn't upfront here. Then in Denny, in the response to interrogatories, there was specific discussion of reasonable expectations, a breach of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing. Then in the summary judgment motion, the claim was specifically discussed, and then it was specifically raised in the TMO. And then the city of Denver objected, saying, well, it wasn't raised until the TMO and we were prejudiced. Here, it was never even raised in the TMO. It wasn't raised anywhere in discovery. They never argued anything about reasonable expectations. They never argued that we abused our discretion. For example, here, the only discretion that one could find in any of the contracts that's relevant here would be under the maintenance easement, where we had the discretion to do, maintain, repair, inspect, etc. Nobody ever argued. Nobody ever elicited any testimony from the experts, from their witnesses, from any witness, as to what type of maintenance was reasonably expected under that type of grant, that type of right, when whether what we did went beyond what was expected. Certainly it was argued by counsel when the court ruled in their favor on that. But when you look at the trial transcript, there was never any question about the scope of the work. They did complain and raised evidence that the quality of the work was below the standard of care, but the court didn't find that. The court's finding was based on the scope of the work. And unlike the Denny case, there was no notice. We had no opportunity to defend on that basis. We had no even suspicion that they were contesting the scope of the work because everything that they said related to the quality of the work.
Counsel, can you give me the citation to the Denny case again, please?
Yes, it's the Court of Appeals case in Denny. It's 170 P. 3rd 733. It was later reversed on other grounds by the Supreme Court. Your Honor, I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you. You have about a minute and 25 seconds. Counsel, and before the clock starts to run, let me just ask you, would you like, I just checked here and I don't see the Denny case cited in any of the briefs. Would you like an opportunity to respond to the arguments about that case in a short written statement to us, or are you prepared to do it today, or do you not want to respond at all? But we will give you that option if you want to be able to respond.
I'm not familiar with the case, but I don't think that we need an opportunity to respond. I think that I can address any of the court's concerns about the good faith and fair dealing issue without that.
Fine. I just wanted to give you that option. Thank you.
Thank you. Patricia Campbell, 24495, on behalf of the Appley Baseline Lakes. The court's findings and conclusions were remarkably comprehensive, and methodical and detailed. And what the court did is, at every stage, give the district the benefit of the doubt. We don't think there's a, or I don't think there's a breach, but if there's a breach, he has improved damages. I think that the obligation, baseline's obligation to repair stopped it this day when the construction started, but even if it didn't, the district's construction interfered with baseline's obligation. So at every stage, it's give the district the benefit of the doubt. And what the district is doing in its briefs, and then again here today, is trying to just conflate the court's findings and the context of who had the burdens, and it's just not what happened. And I think if you step back from the weeds and look at things in a big picture, it's clear that what the court did is perfectly reasonable. First, remember what happened at trial. Baseline was the plaintiff. Baseline went first. Right. Baseline, by the time the district ever got up to present its case, had its fact witnesses and all its expert testimony. So all that evidence about the scope of the construction, the quality of the construction, that was already out there before the district ever presented its case. So when we're talking about burdens and affirmative defenses, Baseline had put on all of its case that talked about this construction, how massive, how disruptive, how much it changed these reservoirs. And we can talk about scope versus quality, and quite frankly, I don't understand that argument, because if you read the transcript, if you read Steve Brown's testimony, that was the Baseline's expert, it's just voluminous testimony about everything that this construction project did to the reservoirs. And the court, in its findings, did conclude that the construction interfered with Baseline's obligation, if in fact Baseline even had an obligation. And it's at the bottom of page 10. The increase in the dam height, lowering of the reservoir floor, and the ineffective spillway increased the amount of water stored in the reservoir, which increased the water's pressure on the surrounding soils, and which increased the likely seepage by some amount.
Pardon me, counsel, but I want to give you the same opportunity that I gave to your learned colleague, and I was asking him about intervening cause. The trial court did not mention intervening cause in the ruling. Am I off base in thinking that that was somehow subsumed within the trial court's findings?
Yes, I absolutely agree, and I think, let me find...
That I am off base?
No, excuse me. That it was subsumed. And if you look at page 15, the way the court phrased it is the district's construction excused Baseline's performance. So let me, if I could, talk about that, the reasonable duration. And I think it goes to two things. One, when did Baseline have the obligation? If it doesn't have the obligation to repair, there can't be a breach. And two, whether it's excusing Baseline's performance or acting as an intervening cause. The court, we start with the fact that the court found that this provision relating to the duty to monitor and repair was ambiguous. There is no time period set forth. So the court did what it was supposed to, which was impose a reasonable time period. Okay. The district came into court and said, Baseline's obligation to repair is infinite. Okay. So they were ready and fully prepared to argue the issue of how long does the repair obligation last?
Excuse me, counsel, where did the district say that they believe Baseline's duty was perpetual or infinite?
Certainly their expert, Mr. Spitzer, said that, and I'm not sure if I, let me see if I can find the
Look, I can look site, for his testimony. Mr. Spitzer, you're saying?
Yes, Mr. Spitzer, and then there was, I believe, some dialogue between the court and Mr. Forbes during what constituted closing arguments.
Okay.
But there's no doubt it was the district's position that it was an infinite obligation.
Thank you.
And Mr. the negotiator for the district came in, and he was, Baseline called him in their case, and they said, do you think it's infinite? And he said, no, I think that it should, the idea was that it would be for a reasonable time. That's where the court came up with the reasonable time duration. It was based on the evidence in the record.
And pardon me, counsel, who testified to that?
It was Mr. Barbera, excuse me. And he was a witness, again, that was the district's witness, but Baseline called him in Baseline's case in chief. So that's where that comes from. So the court is trying to determine, all right, well, how long does this obligation last?
And didn't Mr. Barbera testify to how long he thought the obligation lasted, which was at least a couple years or something? Didn't he say
that?
Well,
he said it would be a reasonable time under the circumstances. And then what the court said is, all right, I'm going to look at all of the facts and circumstances of this case. What would be a reasonable time? And the court concluded that given this massive construction project, this wasn't just minor repairs or any maintenance. They went in to try to make these reservoirs bigger. They lowered the bottom, they raised the sides, they flattened the slopes. The what's called the upstream slope, which is the inside, the downstream slope, which is the outside. All of those things, the testimony was, could certainly increase seepage. So the court determined that under all of the circumstances of this case, a reasonable time for Baseline's obligation would be until the district commenced construction.
So let me, I'm trying to get in my own mind this kind of cascade of issues and how they relate to each other. So if this division were to say, okay, the court got it right on the issue of, number one, it only had to be a reasonable time, and two, under the circumstances here, the reasonable time is up until when the district starts this construction project. Does that then end the case, or is there any argument that up until that time there was a breach?
It does end the case, but even if it didn't, the court...
Well, I understand what the court did, but I'm just trying to understand what the impact of that ruling is, because it's kind of maybe what Judge Terry was asking, is that once you set that as the reasonable period, isn't it night follows from day that there's not going to be a breach?
It does, because of the court's factual findings. Which, again, kind of stepping back, what the court found is that there was no evidence to support a finding that before construction there was any leakage that was greater than 5 gallons per minute. The court's second factual finding was that even after construction, although there were certainly observations of increased seepage when the water was raised to too high a level, there also was no measurement under normal circumstances of greater than 5 gallons per minute of leakage. But before, okay, during that reasonable time period, there was simply no evidence in the record that the reservoirs were leaking more than 5 gallons per minute. If there was no leakage, there's no breach. If there's no breach, there's no recovery, and you don't even have to get to the damage issue. So the court could have stopped there. What the court tried to do is go on and say, all right, but you know, if that's not true, then we're going to look at breach after the construction. Then we're going to look at damages. So by being very thorough, I think that the court's rulings have been kind of turned around. But looking at those three factual issues, was there evidence that the leakage was greater than 5 gallons per minute before construction or before conveyance? Was there evidence supporting leakage of 5 gallons per minute after construction? Did the district prove damages? Court found no to all of those. And in order to reverse, this court would have to find that the trial court abused its discretion on all three of those issues.
Is it abuse of discretion, or is it a question of whether the record supports the court's factual findings? Or is that just... Or is that how you're interpreting what an abuse of discretion is there?
That's how I was interpreting what the court's discretion. There's certainly substantial evidence in the record about all of those issues.
Counsel, can I interrupt you now that you're sort of at a stopping point? The appellant argues that the trial court essentially rewrote the contract by requiring to require the district to take measurements before they were allowed to do any maintenance under their maintenance easement. What do you say to that argument?
I think that you can look at it two ways. What happened was the parties were in a hurry to close the conveyance. But certainly after the conveyance, all right, but before construction, there was no immediate need to make these reservoirs larger. So a reasonable time would have been time necessary to test the reservoirs. If you're going to hold another party to a breach or claim a breach, then you need to know what the baseline is. I mean, was it, no pun intended, you know, was it leaking more than 5 gallons per minute? And if you're going to go in and make massive changes to these reservoirs, that what happened was they actually made the reservoirs worse. That was what the weight of evidence showed. Then yes, it is your responsibility to know what was going on with these reservoirs before you bring your bulldozers in there, before you don't have any construction logs. There's simply no records of what they did. So yes, if you're going to hold another party to a contract and claim a breach, it should be your obligation. And the evidence, whether whoever's burden it was, the evidence, there was no evidence because they didn't do it. They simply didn't test those reservoirs.
Pardon me, counsel, I may have misheard you. I thought you said a few minutes ago that the trial court found that even after the construction, there was no evidence of seepage in excess of 5 gallons per minute. I'm not seeing that in the trial court's order.
In fact, I'm sort of seeing the opposite of that on page 11 of the trial court's order.
Yeah, me too.
What the court found is that and on the top of page 12, the court is referring to Exhibit 23, and that was a 2008 report from Deer and Alt, which was the district's expert. And what that says is when the water level is at a normal level, then there did not seem to be any extensive seepage. But when the reservoirs were filled to the brim, then it was observed. So what the court concluded, and the court asked numerous questions about this and asked Mr. Forbes about it at the very end of the testimony, is why don't you just keep the reservoirs at normal levels and then there won't be excess seepage. But there's no evidence that the reservoirs under normal conditions were leaking more than 5 gallons per minute. There's, you know, as I said, there was certainly a lot of evidence that when they were filled to the brim.
What about the court's finding on page 11 where it says that post-construction seepage is measurable because the interceptor drain system gathered water, the pump station, and that was measured as high as 50 gallons per minute?
There was a time, I think right after construction, where it's my understanding that there was some evidence that there was a blockage of a pipe and that there was greatly excessive seepage, and that was fixed. That pipe was fixed. And the court did say that it could be measured, but there was no evidence in the record of what those measurements were and whether they exceeded 5 gallons per minute, again, when the reservoir is used as the district's expert said it should be. Because what the expert said is, you know, it's simply not a good practice to fill those reservoirs as high as they were. Just briefly, let me address the good faith and fair dealing. The court was talking about the construction project and the party's obligation. And the court did mention good faith and fair dealing, but it was in the context of looking at reasonable expectations of the parties? You know, was it really fair to come in and do all of this construction? And then the court refers to the fact that, I think he cites the restatement provision where an example of bad faith is interfering with performance. So the court is, all the court's doing is talking about the baseline's defenses, but he did get to it through a different way.
And thank you, counsel. Your time is up. Thank you very much. Mr. Forbes, you've got a minute and 25, and let me ask the bailiff if you add another 20 seconds onto that just to kind of account for the excess.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just want to respond quickly to a few points. First, if you check the record, you'll see we never stated at any point that the duration was infinite. They never stated at any point that the duration was limited. The reason for that is it was not an issue that was raised by the parties. It was not an issue at trial or in the pleadings.
But don't you think the trial court had to make such a finding in order to interpret the contract?
Well, Your Honor, it's an interesting question because you have a dispute between the parties. The parties have put in dispute certain aspects of the contract, but not other aspects of the contract. I think that the parties are going to litigate the parts that are put in dispute. An example would be if you have a dispute over a deed of trust. I mean, they're 20 pages long. Do I, by disputing one part with the other party, say a reasonable, you know, reasonable insolvency clause, a reasonable concern clause, do I then have to also be prepared to litigate every other term of the contract? So, Your Honor, in this case, no. The parties defined the issues, and there was never an issue raised concerning ambiguity or the length of the scope. You were also right, Mr. Barbera did say 1 to 2 years. That's in the record 1693:21 to 1695:20. As far as the reasonable expectation goes, the problem here is that this is not the type of thing, in other words, what kind of maintenance is normal maintenance on a reservoir that is within the ken of normal people? You would have to have expert testimony to say this went beyond what was normal, beyond what could be expected under a maintenance easement like that. That testimony was not presented because it was not an issue. They never said you went too far, you did too much. They said they didn't like the way we did it, but they never said you did too much. And my time is up, and I thank the panel very much on behalf of my client.
Thank you, Mr. Forbes. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments. The case will stand submitted. The division will issue an opinion in due course.